history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you that if you take the time to listen to some of their stories, you might be surprised by the wonderful and amazing things they did for the sake of our freedom. Each week we visit with members of our greatest generation. Our goal is to honor them, honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained, for sure, and so often inspired. And I'm pretty sure that's going to be the case today with the tiebreaker, the baby boy, the 11th of 11 children. It was five boys, five girls till you came along. And Cal Erickson of Santa Clarita, California, our guest today, growing up in the San Joaquin Valley as the youngest of 11. What was that like?
Oh, interesting. I was kind of babied by my older sisters. I pretty much got spoiled by them, I guess, but it was fun.
I imagine so. And this was what, about southeast of Fresno, around the Sanger, California area?
Right, yeah. Sanger and Del Rey.
Farmers?
Yes, my dad was a farmer all his life. He didn't own property. He rented various properties.
So did you have to work on the farm?
Oh, yeah.
What kind of question is that, right? Why do you think they had 11 kids? They needed people working on the farm.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Give us a taste of that, those early years. What kind of work would you have to do around the farm?
Well, started out with just routine small matters. And then as I got older, it was pruning the grapevines mostly is what we had.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of pruning and tying up the vines and turning the trays when we picked the grapes. We'd put them on trays, and then we have to turn them. And so I got involved in that.
I bet you still enjoy raisins today. Or are
I
you
do.
Sick of them?
I do.
All right. Me too. We're here in, well, are we in Santa Clarita or are we in Saugus?
We used to just call it Saugus. Then they changed this whole community around here to Santa Clarita, which was Saugus and Newhall and Valencia and Canyon Country.
Mm-hmm.
But we still call it Saugus.
Because Los Angeles just kept growing and growing north and swallowing you up, huh?
That's right.
For folks who aren't familiar with this part of California, we're right on the edge of the grapevine, the mountain range that separates Southern California from the great San Joaquin Valley. You've been here for, I guess about 35 years, but we were talking about your growing up years, and we're going to talk about your Army Air Corps years and why there's an air medal on your wall over here. But on that farm, with five older brothers doing all this work around the farm, did you start to develop some dreams, some ambitions, some ideas of what you might do when you got off the farm?
Yes, I really wanted to get off the farm. I thought about going to college and maybe becoming a teacher or something like that. In fact, I had a history teacher that wanted us to write an essay about what we wanted to do. And I said, well, in my essay, I wrote that it's probably worthless to go to college now because I'm going to be in the service. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote it right across the top, says that education is important no matter if you go to service or not, you know. So I never did go back to college. I went right into the service.
Well, and you had some brothers to follow into the service, and I want to talk about that. But I also want to ask you, I don't want to forget to ask you about a date I'm sure you remember, because you were looking forward to your 18th birthday. And less than a week before your 18th birthday, the world changed on you a little bit. December 7th, 1941. Right. What do you remember about that day?
I remember it as very, very sad. I knew that we were going to go to war, and I didn't, at that age, I didn't know whether we were going to go to war with just Japan or if we were going to Germany or where we were going to end up, but I knew that one way or another we were in a war.
Did you hear it on the radio? Did someone come tell you? Do you remember how you found out?
It was on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And her, of course, heard Roosevelt's speech, you know, the next day or the
right.
2 days later or something.
Mm-hmm.
The day of infamy.
Yeah.
Which was certainly true. other than that, I wanted to get in the service, and I also didn't want to, I wanted to be a pilot rather than go in the ground service.
Mm-hmm. And at that point, when Pearl Harbor was attacked, did you already have brothers in the service or not yet?
I believe one of my brothers was in service, yeah.
So I was just imagining, you know, your folks, if all of a sudden there's a war going on and one of them's already in uniform, they're probably getting a little nervous about it.
I imagine they were, yeah.
And then you and the other brothers say, hey, we want to go too. And they're saying, what is going on here? So you said you wanted to be a pilot. Had you ever been in a plane before?
No.
You just seen them flying over the farm?
Saw them in the air, and I said, that's what I want to do.
And a lot of guys had that dream, but not everybody accomplished that dream. How did it proceed from there for you?
Well, I went up to Hammer Field in Fresno. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's still there or not.
It's now the Fresno Yosemite International Airport. It's okay. Not a military installation, but well, the 144th Fighter Wing of the Air National Guard is there. But mm-hmm. The runway is still there.
Yeah. Yeah, I went up there. One of my sisters took me up there, and I went through the procedure of applying for the Air Force. I don't recall exactly how it happened, but I don't know if I took physicals right then. I believe I did. Mm-hmm. Physicals and written tests and so forth. They said, well, you know, don't call us, we'll call you. So in the meantime, I had to register for the draft. I kept working. I was working at a neighbor's farm. I was getting worried that my draft number was about up. So I did get notice to report in the draft. And then one day, before I went, one of my sisters came out where I was working, and she said, you've been called to the Air Force. I missed the draft by maybe just a few days.
Yeah.
By going into service, and I got my wish.
You would have ended up probably in the infantry somewhere.
Probably, yeah.
Instead, you ended up in a B-26 bomber. But you mentioned she came to you while you were working, and we already heard you're working on the farm all the time. So you're out there pruning some grapevines or what?
Yeah, pruning the grapevines. I just threw the shears up in the air and quit.
That was your celebration, throw the pruning shears up in the air.
That's it, yeah.
You throw them up in the air, they've got to come down somewhere, though. That's a little scary.
That's true, yeah, but I watched it.
You managed to survive. So you were excited to have that opportunity. But everybody I've talked to, that process from going to enlisting in the Army Air Corps mm-hmm. and actually earning those wings, which I see on your wall here, that wasn't always an easy process. What were some of the bumps in the roads or the challenges that you faced?
Well, first of all, I was in, there are three divisions you have to go through. It's primary, basic, and advanced training.
Right.
So in each phase, there's quite a few people eliminated because of one thing or another. And I flew in the Stearman primary. It's a biplane.
Yeah.
Very, very acrobatic plane, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
We did a lot of that. One of the things about it had a very narrow landing gear. It was easy, if you don't land it correctly, it was easy to, what they call, ground loop.
Uh-huh.
And if you did that, you're pretty well done for.
And they wash you out of the program?
Wash you out.
Yeah.
And so I think on my final day of the primary, I came in. It was a crosswind, and I was pretty scared about it, but came in and landed it okay. You kind of side-slip in a little bit, and then you straighten out and land, and made a perfect landing, and so that was one of the things I went through.
Mm-hmm. Was it a thrill for you to be up in the air at the control of this big machine?
Oh, you can't. Just don't know how thrilling it was, yeah. Very, very good.
And you had four of your brothers that also served in the war.
Mm-hmm.
Were any of them envious that you were flying?
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think so.
They had some adventures of their own, I know.
Yeah.
The other thing that a lot of people don't realize is how dangerous this was at the time. I mean, we think of air travel today as so routine and mm-hmm. so normalized, but
yeah.
It was a really new frontier in the 1940s. I mean, airplanes had only been around for three decades or so, and these warplanes are getting turned out, and they're new all the time, and people didn't even know what they were capable of. And the plane you ended up flying in combat was a plane that kind of had an infamous moniker or two before you ever stepped foot in one.
It sure did, yeah. I didn't realize it at the time. It had such a bad name.
We're talking about the B-26, the Marauder, but it had some other nicknames.
Yeah, they call it the Widowmaker.
Uh-oh.
The Flying Coffin. And there was another one that the Flying Prostitute, no visible means of support.
Uh-huh. So yeah.
We had all those names. Actually, though, that was the first B-26s. They were very, very difficult to fly, and they modified it a little bit over the years, made the wings a little bit so they had a little better lift.
And am I swapping stories, or is that when they came up with a plane a day in Tampa Bay? Because so many of them were coming out of the sky and crashing.
That's right.
But none of that hit. You didn't catch wind of any of that as you were training.
No, I saw the B-26 land when I was in my first phase, primary.
Uh-huh.
And it landed on a runway, and I thought, that's a beautiful-looking plane, nice and symmetrical. And so I asked for the plane all the way through training, and they were glad to give it to me, I guess.
Sucker.
And another sucker.
Well, what was that plane like to fly? And explain to our listeners, because they hear a lot about a B-17, a B-24, B-25, probably even a B-29 later on. But you don't hear a whole lot about B-26s.
No, you don't. And actually, it had a very good war record,
mm-hmm.
One of the best. I didn't, find it that difficult to fly, but, you had to be on your toes.
What did you appreciate about it? What were the pluses and minuses of that plane, as you understood them?
Well, the pluses would be, once you got up in the air, it was very fast and, very controllable. The minuses, of course, were getting up in the air in the first place. Sometimes you just got to the end of the runway and pulled the wheels up and hope you got off.
Yeah, I could see that being a little hair-raising.
But I didn't find anything too negative about it, no.
And I guess I should ask you, too, because before you were assigned to B-26s, you had to earn your wings. There's a picture in a little book that you have here, Memories of a World War II Pilot, that explains some of your exploits. And there's a picture of you when you got your wings in May of 1944 at the age of 20. You got a pretty good smile on your face. What did that mean to you to earn those wings?
Oh, it meant everything. All my dreams had come true. And well, I knew that though the training was over, in the smaller planes, and I knew that there would be other obstacles to go through to get the be approved for a B-26 pilot.
Yeah, and you write a little bit about that in your book. And one thing you stated here is that only 50% of the officers would be pilots with their own crews. And that's obviously a goal that you're shooting for, one that's not easy to attain. And why don't you walk us through how that happened for you?
At the end of the B-26 training, which involved a lot of cross-country and formation flying and so forth, the last day you had to take a test flight with one of the higher-ups in the base. And I had never flown with anybody except my instructor before, and I, as luck would have it, I got the base commander.
Whoa.
Which was pretty scary.
Uh-huh.
But I have been forewarned that they'll sometimes get up in the air there and they'll shut off an engine on you, and then you have to scramble, and sometimes you might do something with the other engine. Because when an engine goes out, you have to stop the propellers so it doesn't have a lot of drag.
And unlike a B-17, where you would have had four engines, on the B-26, you only have two.
You have two, yeah.
So so one goes out, that's half your horsepower.
Yeah.
And that happened on this training flight where you're trying to qualify to lead a crew?
Yeah.
He purposely turned off an engine.
Turned off an engine, and so I thankfully feathered the right one and kept flying. But it's you can't. I don't know if you could go very far on one engine in the 26 because it's so
heavy.
Heavy needs all that power of both engines.
I think most folks are familiar with what feathering the prop means, but explain that to them because it does make a difference. If you don't do this, then that propeller, even though the engine's off, is going to actually slow down your plane more.
That's right. Yeah, you feather it, and that way it's parallel with the wind, and it doesn't turn anymore, and then that enables you to keep flying. Yeah,
right. So you did it the right way. You passed your test, and you would get to fly B-26s in Europe. We want to hear about that. We'll get to it after the break. Cal Erickson, 92 years old, is our guest today. If you'd like to see photos of Cal, even a short video of Cal and his wife, Jean, who just celebrated their 68th anniversary, pull up Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook or just go to hometownheroesradio.com. We'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.